Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind. Later on in this hour, we're going to delve into the new era of climate regulation for corporate America that tries to account for carbon emissions and the risks posed by climate change. Will new reporting and disclosure requirements ultimately help reduce carbon emissions? And should the state's pension funds, CalSTRS and CalPERS, be required to divest their interests in fossil fuels? Helping us untangle these topics will be our guests, former California Insurance Commissioner Dave Jones, Kirsten Snow Spaulding of Ceres Investor Network, and Malin Clark of Third Economy, a corporate sustainability consulting firm. And then last in this hour, we'll talk to Marta Carrillo, coach of the all-girls robotics team, the Jenksters, who've been entering Bay Area robotics competitions with their 125-pound robot, Rosa. But first, let's turn our attention to the results of the March 5th election that happened last week. And joining us tonight to help us understand those results is Joe Eskenazi, managing editor of Mission Local. Welcome back to State of the Bay, Joe.
Well, thank you for having me on the show.
It's great to have you, not only as a returning guest, but of course you have guest hosted this program before. So happy to have you back on. And let's start first with the voter turnout on March 5th. Was that what you expected it to be? Because I know statewide turnout was a bit low. So I'm curious your take, especially in the Bay Area here.
Well, I think the meme that the kids put up is the guy from the show saying not great, not terrible. And 44.5% right now with 9,000 votes to go puts us up at around 46.5%, which is not off par for what we get in midterm elections. Is it great that 46% of San Franciscans showed up to vote when it's never been easier to vote? They mail the ballots right to your house, so you don't have to put on a stamp. No, that's not great. But, you know, 46.5% for a primary with no scintillating races is not so bad.
All right. Well, let's talk about one of those, you know, maybe a little bit more scintillating given the stakes of the election here. We had Proposition 1, which was a statewide measure funding mental health facilities. It needs 50% to pass. Last I checked, it still has not been decided. I'm interested to hear from you what it's looking like, which way you think it will ultimately go, and should the governor have campaigned harder for this proposition, given that it seemed like he staked a fair amount of his sort of political reputation on this one passing?
Well, he certainly got a boost from people in San Francisco. I think 73% of San Franciscans voted yes on it, for whatever that's worth. Certainly he should have done more. It shouldn't have been so close. This is the third, you know, leg of the stool for all of his plans to deal with the state's mental health crisis. So, you know, if it passes, you know, God bless to him, that would be great. But if not, it'll be like the 49ers in the Super Bowl. You can look at a million different factors that that should have gone differently and would have affected the outcome of the contest.
And ultimately, you know, potentially coming down here to overtime, as we're seeing. I'm just curious real quick on Proposition 1. What do you think is the reason it ended up being so close? It seems like otherwise this ought to be relatively non-controversial.
Well, I can't speak for state ballot propositions where I have no special expertise, but it did not have universal support. And I think, you know, a lot of Californians are probably wary of anything. You know, it's certainly I've always thought that anything you vote for, you should imagine, will this be used against me? You know, and I think that nobody likes to be involuntarily committed. So certainly, you know, it's an unpleasant topic, and there's been overreach in the past in this state. And I don't see why it should have been taken as a given that people would just do what Gavin Newsom wanted.
Well, let's talk a little bit more locally here about what happened in San Francisco. Voters had seven measures to decide, including propositions that concern police staffing, drug screenings for public assistance recipients, and even eighth grade math, which passed by a landslide. And meanwhile, moderates and progressives are battling for control of the Democratic County Central Committee, or DCCC. Maybe we could start with that one, Joe. Can you just talk a little bit about the DCCC? We covered this on the preview show for this election coming up before it happened, but wondering if you can just remind regular listeners of what the DCCC is and why control of it is so important.
Sure. Even educated people who are informed voters and, you know, have professional jobs are often bewildered to open up the ballot and see, you know, dozens of names of people they've never heard of. And you're voting for people on a body you've never heard of called the DCCC. And what it is essentially the group that makes up the local Democratic Party. And there's a lot of stuff that they have to go through, procedurally. But the important one is making endorsements in local elections. So clearly, if you have, two factions of local government, it behooves you to control the Democratic Party in a city where Democrats outnumber registered Republicans 9-1. So that's what at issue here.
It's definitely Democrat versus Democrat when it comes to San Francisco politics. Let's talk about some of the San Francisco ballot measures. Mayor London Breed got her wish with Propositions E and F, which both passed. And Joe, maybe we can start with the most controversial proposition on the ballot of those. That's Proposition E, which will expand police powers. Can you talk about what might change now as a result of this proposition passing?
Sure. The measure does a lot of things which are not interrelated. And so certainly somebody who doesn't like one of those things could be inclined to vote against it. And it actually, is passing at a lower level than many thought it would. It's at like about 55-45, which is a number that comes up a lot in San Francisco citywide races. What it would allow police to do is pursue a broader swath of suspects, including for, quote, violent misdemeanors, which is a term that actually has no legal meaning. But it was understood to mean property criminals, people who break into cars, people who steal from stores, etc. It also allows for more oversight without surveillance by police without oversight. It reduces use of force reporting requirements for police. All of these things, and on top of that, it also it saddles the police commission with onerous requirements to talk to the public before passing any requirements, requirements of the sort that have been taken away from market rate development because they are clearly just a way of keeping that from happening. So that's a funny dichotomy there. So there's a lot that could happen.
All right. Well, we're speaking with Joe Eskenazi, managing editor of Mission Local, about the election results and how they might affect San Francisco in particular. Let's talk about Proposition F, which Mayor London Breed also backed, and that will require drug screening for people receiving public assistance. Joe, who do you think this is going to impact? What's the expected change here?
Well, it may end up impacting nobody because the city's largest union is going to take legal aim at it. And failing that could go out on strike. So that would mean nothing happens. And it also could affect nobody because the mandatory treatment that that people who are found to be using drugs would be placed into doesn't exist. We can't serve the people that want to be treated now, let alone the people who don't want to be treated and will be compelled into treatment. So, I'm not sure how this is actually going to work in real life or if anybody even really cared about that. This is something I've written before that was a very political measure. And it appealed to people. San Franciscans, no matter what you hear about how liberal we are, have a long streak on the citywide level of measures that that take liberties away from the poor or the homeless, starting with Care Not Cash, an aggressive panhandling measure. There was a Proposition Q, which took people's tents away. There's the sit-lie measure, and this one comes right after that. So certainly, a politician who wants to say that we need to rein in the homeless and people need to have their allowance taken away is not necessarily going out on a limb in San Francisco.
So maybe more symbol than substance. I guess we'll see how it plays out. Now, zooming out mm-hmm. a bit, it's an election year for Mayor Breed. My understanding is she's been down in the polls, but do you think the success of these two propositions that she was so closely identified with and may to some extent help address some of her political weaknesses, do you think that will help her chances for re-election come November?
My mother has an expression, which is no. Does no work for you? No, I don't think that will help at all. I don't think that anybody going to the polls months from now, when turnout will be a little less than double what it is going to look back and think about the March primary.
All right.
I think that these issues are, the city, the state of the city, the mayor just had her state of the city speech, and the state of the city at this moment looks much as it did last week. And I imagine it will look much as it will next week. And that's what's going to be on people's minds are the things that fairly or unfairly show up on television, show up on your viral videos of people behaving strangely in public, or filthy conditions, or things like that. Mm-hmm. And that's hard to deal with because it's how people feel.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's certainly really intractable problems that she's trying to address here with these.
But more than that, it's how people feel.
That's the feeling.
And the statistics that she's now taking out about what's actually happening, while true, are not the same thing as how people feel.
Yes. All right. Well, we'll have to follow this race. We have time for just one more question here, which is the two bond measures that were just called today. Measure A allows San Francisco to issue $300 million bond to build affordable housing. Voters have already approved a number of bonds in the past. We had a $315 million bond in 2015, another $600 million bond in 2019. Is another $300 million going to make much of a dent in solving our housing crisis?
Well, no, but also it enables us to treble that with state and federal funding. So it's actually closer to a billion. And so the number of units that could be built is more than 1,000 if things go well. And this one was a big surprise. Nobody I talked to expected this one to pass. Nobody. Because the general public is surly. And because as you said, we've passed stuff in the past and it, hasn't made a tangible difference. So this was a big surprise. And any assessments, any barstool arguments you have about the liberal or not liberal nature of San Francisco voters, this factors in. It was unexpected that this would pass the way it did.
I agree. It seems like it's hard to read the tea leaves here when you step back and look at all the election results. But we're very glad to have you here to help explain some of this. Joe Eskenazi, managing editor of Mission Local. Thanks so much for coming back on State of the Bay.
Anytime.
All right. Coming up next on State of the Bay, we're going to talk about a new era for corporate America and reporting requirements for carbon emissions and disclosing the financial risks associated with climate change. Will these kinds of regulations ultimately help us curb greenhouse gas emissions? We'll find out. That's right after the break. So stay with us. Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind. We want you to be a part of this next conversation. If you're a teacher or a state employee, do you think your pension fund should divest from fossil fuels? Or maybe you work for an oil and gas company. Do you feel like this industry is unfairly stigmatized? We'd love to hear from you. You can give us a call. We're at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also find us on social media or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. So continuing our climate series here on State of the Bay, new laws passed last fall in California and a new set of rules issued just this past Wednesday by the Securities and Exchange Commission, or SEC, will require certain companies to begin officially tracking and disclosing their carbon emissions, as well as other financial risks posed by climate change. This policy is going to affect a range of industries, notably insurance companies that are paying out ever-increasing amounts due to the damage wrought by severe weather events like wildfires and floods. But then they're taking the billions of dollars that they collect from our premiums and doubling down on investments in the fossil fuel companies that are contributing to climate change that's causing this damage. And meanwhile, here in California, a bill introduced this past fall would require the biggest state pension funds, that's CalSTRS and CalPERS, to divest from fossil fuel interests, but it hasn't yet made it out of committee in the legislature. So can we expect these regulations on capital markets to help us solve climate change? We're joined by three experts tonight who can help us gain some more insight into answering just that question. So first, let me welcome former California Insurance Commissioner Dave Jones. He is the director of the Climate Risk Initiative at UC Berkeley's Center for Law, Energy, and the Environment, where he is my colleague there. He's also, as I mentioned, former insurance commissioner. So welcome, Dave Jones.
Thanks, Ethan.
And we're also pleased to welcome Reverend Kirsten Snow Spaulding. Kirsten leads the Ceres Investor Network. And prior to joining Ceres, she served as Chief Deputy Treasurer under California Treasurer Phil Angelides. So welcome, Kirsten.
Delighted to be with you.
And last but certainly not least, we want to welcome Malin Clark, partner at Third Economy, a corporate sustainability consulting firm. Welcome, Malin.
Thank you very much.
All right, Dave Jones, let me start with you. You served two terms as California's insurance commissioner from 2011 to 2018. You're responsible for regulating the largest insurance market in the U.S. And in 2016, you launched the Climate Risk Carbon Initiative, which required insurers to disclose publicly their investments in fossil fuels like coal, oil, gas, as well as utilities. And you asked insurers to divest investments in coal specifically. Can you talk about why you took that step and what the impact was of this disclosure and divestment requirement?
So as a financial regulator, one big concern I had was that insurance companies and more broadly, financial institutions and financial markets were not considering the physical impact of climate change and also the impact of transitioning away from fossil fuels and other greenhouse gas emitting industries. And so one objective I had was to get insurance companies to start thinking about not only how climate change is impacting the writing of insurance, whether it's wildfires, floods, heavy rains, droughts, extreme heat, but also to look at the investment side of their balance sheet, where they take the billions of dollars that they collect from us in premiums and consider how those investments might be impacted by climate change, and in particular, the transition away from certain industries that are big greenhouse gas emitters. So flashing forward to the present, as you noted in your opening, California enacted two path-breaking laws last year, Senate Bill 261 and Senate Bill 253. Senate Bill 261 requires corporations doing business in California, regardless of where they're headquartered, that have more than $1 billion in annual revenues to report their Scope 1, Scope 2, and Scope 3 greenhouse gas emissions. So what does that mean? Well, Scope 1 are the direct emissions. Scope 2 are the indirect emissions associated with purchasing electricity or heating or cooling their operations. And Scope 3 are the emissions upstream and downstream. So that was actually Senate Bill 253 by Scott Wiener that required that emissions reporting. And that is hugely impactful because for the first time, we have a law in the books that will require that emissions reporting. The second bill was SB 261 from Henry Stern that requires companies that have more than $500 million a year operating in California, regardless of where they're headquartered. So these are companies across the United States to report the impacts of climate change on those companies and the financial risks associated with climate change as well. So that's a critically important piece of legislation too. And then just last week, the Securities and Exchange Commission issued a new rule for publicly traded companies that requires some level of disclosure of the climate risk those companies face, as well as some level of emissions reporting. Sadly, however, the SEC did not go to where they should have gone, which is to require Scope 1, Scope 2, and Scope 3 emissions reporting. They stopped at Scope 1 and 2, and they're only applying that to companies that have more than $75 million in value. So they basically excused smaller publicly traded companies from doing any emissions reporting whatsoever. So I'll stop there. I'm sure my colleagues will want to add some additional commentary, but
I do want to follow up on a couple of things you mentioned, but you did define briefly Scope 1, Scope 2, 3, Scope 2. Can you just talk, zoom out a little bit, where those come from, those terms, Scope 1 and 2 and 3, who came up with them and why they matter?
Sure. Well, so there is a internationally accepted greenhouse emissions reporting framework and protocol. Where these definitions have been developed over time with a lot of input from the private sector, from private corporations, as well as from financial institutions. So these are commonly accepted definitions that are actually being enacted into laws in Europe and in Asia by their financial regulators and by their corporate regulators, less so in the United States until recently. But these sort of three categories of emissions are not only been embraced internationally, but are also being used voluntarily by corporations and financial institutions in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate you explaining that. And, you know, Dave, I was asking about your time as insurance commissioner, because in many ways, even leaving aside what we've just seen recently from the legislature and just last week from the SEC, you really in some ways took the first steps by requiring that kind of disclosure and divestment from utility companies. And I'm curious if there are some lessons learned from your experience as California Insurance Commissioner that maybe we need to keep in mind or that we might be seeing playing out now in this more widespread round of regulation that we're seeing.
I think one important takeaway from that early work is the importance of having uniformity in terms of reporting requirements. And that makes it easier for investors and shareholders and financial institutions and regulators to look at the data and compare it. Unfortunately, the SEC decided to go in a direction that is not completely comparable with California's laws and also falls short of what European financial regulators and corporate regulators are requiring, as well as Asian financial regulators and corporate regulators. So that's a problem, because that is going to cause a real challenge for U.S. corporations that are operating overseas that are going to be hit with these conflicting reporting regimes. So one takeaway from my early work was the importance of having alignment in reporting requirements, and unfortunately the SEC failed in that measure. The other is making sure that you get as complete a set of disclosures as possible. And you know, great that the SEC issued the rule, but they fell short in terms of requiring Scope 3 emissions, which around which there's a lot of agreement that you really need to understand what the Scope 3 emissions are, the emissions upstream and downstream of supply chain, to really understand what contribution your company or your financial institution is making to the broader problem. And then finally, something that the SEC did that California did not do on the greenhouse gas emissions side is the SEC imposed a materiality requirement. So that before companies are required to even report their Scope 1 and Scope 2 emissions, they have to decide that they are material from an investor standpoint. And I'm sure that Kirsten or Malin will go into greater detail on this, but sadly, that's going to lead to a lot of litigation, because there can be a lot of debate about, you know, what is material for a reasonable investor who's looking to make decisions about whether to buy or to sell shares of stock. And so I think the SEC fell short in that regard too. Something that you know, we learned from our experience with the insurance companies is the importance of just, you know, having full and broad disclosure without imposing these additional conditions, which then themselves can lead to more dispute and litigation.
Yeah, the wiggle room they leave open absolutely is going to invite a lot of interpretation and litigation. I want to bring in Kirsten Snow Spaulding into this conversation. So, Kirsten, you head up the Ceres Investor Network. First, can you just tell us what Ceres is?
Sure. I'm delighted to be with you. And Ceres is a nonprofit organization. We work with influential companies and investors, really focused on trying to find capital market solutions to some of the world's greatest sustainability challenges. My part of the work, I manage an investor network, a group of institutional investors with about 220 of them, with about $45 trillion in assets under management. And I support those investors as they both think about what they put in their portfolios and also how they engage with the companies that they hold.
And Kirsten, Dave mentioned a couple of those bills that passed in California. He was too humble to mention that he helped draft and really support one of those pieces of legislation. But I know you also were involved. The Ceres sponsored that legislation. And I'm curious, from your perspective, working with these large institutional investors, just, you know, these financial players, what did you see happening in terms of the debate coming out, how they were involved, and what their reaction has been to the implementation and then now to this SEC rule that passed last week?
So the investors that I work with are, just like Dave said, really looking for good data. They want to be able to manage their portfolios effectively. They want to understand the risks, and they want to look for opportunities. They want the best valued companies in those portfolios, because the investors I work with are investing over a really long time. So CalPERS, the Public Employee Retirement System, they care about data because they're going to hold companies not just for this generation, but for generations to come, because they're going to be providing retirement benefits to everybody who works here in California for the next 100 years. So long time horizon. They need good data to look at what's in the portfolio mm-hmm. today and how they're planning forward. I think, you know, both 253 and 262 were really proud of what California did. And it wasn't a crazy thing for them to do to set these disclosure rules. What we know is that investors have been demanding that companies give them good disclosure about climate risk. They've been asking that for a long time. And many, many companies, about 50% of the publicly traded companies, have been voluntarily disclosing their emissions through the Carbon Disclosure Project. They've already been handing this information to investors because they need it. So it made good sense to have a law that would try and standardize this. I'd also say that our investors are global. Well, they're based in one state or in one country, they're invested around the world. So it's really important to get disclosure rules that cut across markets. So we're already seeing in Europe, you know, standards, the new regulations and bills there all require the kind of TCFD disclosure, Task Force on Financial Risk Disclosure, and the Scope 1, 2, and 3 disclosures. So these bills were entirely consistent with what we're seeing around the world and very important to investors. Like Dave, if I could just turn to the SEC for a moment. You know, I'm enthusiastic about the fact that we got a climate risk disclosure rule. So, you know, I have to say this was good news from our perspective. There were over 24,000 comments from investors into that rulemaking process. So investors really cared about it. But like Dave, I'm disappointed that it didn't include everything that investors asked for.
All right. Well, I appreciate that feedback and context on the policies that we've seen adopted here so far. I want to let listeners know this is State of the Bay on local public radio, 91.7 KALW, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Ethan Elkind, and we're discussing corporate disclosures of climate risk, along with the potential for fossil fuel divestment. And we're joined by Dave Jones, director of the Climate Risk Initiative at UC Berkeley's Center for Law, Energy, and the Environment, and former California Insurance Commissioner. Also, Kirsten Snow Spaulding, vice president of the Ceres Investor Network, and Ma-Lynn Clark, partner at Third Economy. And we would love to hear from you. Do you work at a publicly traded company, or do you invest in publicly traded companies? Do you think these companies ought to have to report on their carbon emissions and the other financial risks associated with climate change? What do you think is the right approach for addressing these threats? We'd love to hear from you. You can join us by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Well, Ma-Lynn, let me go to you. I know you help companies move toward their sustainability goals and presumably are going to help them navigate these new disclosure requirements. So how are you feeling about these, first the California laws, the SEC move? How are your clients responding?
Yeah, thank you. I will say that standardization helps on all ends. So knowing what the expectation is, as Kirsten mentioned, there has been a plethora of voluntary frameworks and standards to report against. And one thing to note is that 9 of 10 of the top 1,000 corporate issuers are already reporting some type of climate-related risk information. So there certainly has been a voluntary disclosure that's been developing out there. So having some kind of standardization is important. I do agree that the SEC's rules, while not going as far as California or Europe, at least it's a start. You know, I think they did a good job navigating, listening to the feedback from all perspectives and got something implemented. Now, I'm sure there will be lawsuits, as Dave, you mentioned. We recommend clients, and we are working with 125 or so clients, generally publicly traded companies, but also private issuers or private companies. And any business that has a responsible or running their business in a responsible way will have some type of enterprise risk management system. So to incorporate climate risks into that is just prudent risk management. So ensuring that you understand, and obviously ESG has had a little bit of a bad rap over the last year or so and become very politicized. But really what ESG is all about is that those non-financial risks and opportunities that a company might impact them. If they are material, that might impact them in a financial way as well in the long term. So what we certainly recommend to clients are ensuring that they understand what risks are facing them. I think businesses in general, the physical risks, whether they're acute or chronic, are starting to become more understood. I think the transition risk is where companies are still really trying to get their arms around how does potentially climate risk impact their supply chain. What happens if there's a carbon tax? We know our neighbors in the north, up in Canada, has a carbon tax. We know there's a border control tax that's going into effect in Europe. So certainly there might be a financial impact. But yeah, I will say many clients are already disclosing, and this is just helping to standardize so they know what the rules of the road are.
Malin, you mentioned that ESG has become politicized now. It's sort of a bugaboo for certain conservatives or those opposed to climate action. I'm curious what your clients are saying about it. Do you think this is going to change their behavior, or do you think that the disclosure rules will actually have an on-the-ground change to how they're investing and making decisions and actually help reduce emissions in the process?
Yeah. So what we're seeing in reality, as I mentioned, running your business in a responsible way for shareholder value over the long term means that you are managing risks and taking advantage of opportunities as well. And what companies are doing, and I'd be interested in, Kirsten, the investors that we've spoken to aren't really changing the assessment and what they're looking for in their investment thesis. What they do, though, or have been doing, is changing how they speak about it. So ESG, of course, being more of this umbrella term, now it's more focused on what are we doing around climate? What are we doing around cybersecurity? How are we managing health and safety for our employees? What are we doing about our supply chain? So there's sort of a focus. There's still a focus on the same risks and thinking about how you govern those risks. But yes, the way companies are speaking about it and investors as well has certainly changed based upon the politicization of ESG as a term.
Well, we have an email in from Richard from Marin, who wants to know what our guests think about the divestment movement in universities. And he writes, "Don't we owe the next generation more than investing in these companies that have created so much of the problem?" Well, Kirsten, let me ask you about that. This ties into the SB 252, a bill that I referred to that would prohibit CalPERS and CalSTRS from investing in the 200 most carbon intensive fossil fuel companies. What do you think about this divestment movement with universities?
So especially with universities, I think universities have an important role to play in sending a signal to the market and saying we are not looking forward to a future that is a fossil fuel-based energy economy. That's not what we see in the future. And so a divestment move by a university really sends that signal very clearly to the energy industry, to the energy sector as a whole, and really encourages investors to move away from fossil fuels and into the clean energy alternatives for the future. So having said that, I think it's an important signal for an investor like CalPERS and CalSTRS, and they're the ones that are being impacted by 252. I think it's a different story for them. They're not so much concerned about sending signals. They are concerned about the long-term benefits to the pension to the pensioners and their active employees today. Because after all, the pension is the deferred wages of those public employees and teachers. So they're concerned about making sure that the investments are going to do well and that they're going to be able to pay good retirement benefits. And for them, the question is, which companies are going to be creating value? Now, it's true that the fossil fuel companies, as we look out over the long term, they aren't going to be the winners. But it should be up to the investment staff to make a decision about when to underweight those companies, when to shift in the energy sector to move the money from one set of companies to the companies of the future. They have to really assess the risk and the opportunity. They have to look at the demand and ensure that they are really creating value for the long run. So I think a policy that says just divest from a whole sector, it's going to cause such a hit to the pension fund that it's not advisable. But we have to empower these investors, which these good disclosure bills do, empower them to make good decisions. And over time, they will underweight those companies that don't have a future and really prioritize the ones that are going to create value in the long run.
So if you're just joining us, this is Ethan Elkind hosting State of the Bay, and we're talking about requiring companies to disclose their climate risks and in some cases divest from fossil fuels. Very pleased to be joined by Dave Jones, Director of the Climate Risk Initiative at UC Berkeley's Center for Law, Energy, and the Environment, Kirsten Snow Spaulding from the Ceres Investor Network, and Malin Clark, partner at Third Economy. And we do want to hear from you. The number is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. We're also on social media, or you can email us at stateofthebay@klw.org. Dave Jones, I wanted to ask you about the two California bills that you mentioned that passed last year, SB 253, 261. Do you think this legislation is going to be implemented here in the state as intended, or are you concerned about attempts to water it down or maybe challenges with lawsuits like you just mentioned with the SEC rule that we just saw pass last week?
So the good news is that California once again has led the nation in adopting these two critically important laws. And I think that's also helped to nudge the SEC after its two-year process to move in a similar direction, although perhaps not as I said earlier, as Kristen and Madeline said earlier, perhaps not as far as we would have liked. However, a couple of developments since the two California laws were signed by Governor Gavin Newsom. You may recall the announcement with great fanfare at New York Climate Week that he was going to sign these bills, and it got a lot of international attention. Well, unfortunately, his administration did not include funding in the budget to implement the two bills. Now, the good news is that the budget ultimately is enacted by the legislature, and there was broad legislative support for both California bills. And perhaps even more importantly, one of the authors of the two bills, Senator Scott Wiener from San Francisco, has been named the chair of the Senate Budget Committee and has already indicated his intention, working with his opposite number over in the State Assembly, to make sure that there's funding for both of these critical bills. So I anticipate that there will be funding ultimately put in the budget, that the governor will sign that budget bill, and that the bills will begin to be implemented. The other bad news, though, is that the ink was hardly dry on the bills before the U.S. Chamber of Commerce filed a lawsuit challenging both laws, alleging that they violate companies' First Amendment rights and that they are preempted by the Clean Air Act, and also that they interfere with interstate commerce. All three of those causes of action, I think, are without merit. But the other thing that is noteworthy is that the laws haven't actually gone into effect yet, and already the U.S. Chamber of Commerce filed this. And as both Kirsten and Malin said, many of the chamber's members are actually already voluntarily reporting, and it's actually beneficial to have some standardization of these requirements so that you're not placed at a competitive disadvantage by reporting. And so, you know, I think it's unfortunate that the U.S. Chamber has filed suit. And then on the SEC rule, some 11 conservative states attorneys general have indicated their intention to file a lawsuit against the SEC rule in the 11th Circuit. So You know, sadly, I think we're going to have litigation on both fronts. I believe that both the California laws as well as the SEC rule will ultimately prevail. Mm-hmm. But this sort of litigation brought on behalf of either conservative attorneys generals who are politicizing what is basically an effort to provide investors and shareholders and others with basic financial information is a really unfortunate development. Mm-hmm. And it's just going to add more delay and more confusion and deprive investors and shareholders and consumers and regulators of the information they need if any one of these courts were to decide for some reason to delay implementation of either the SEC rule or the California laws.
I guess this is the downside of being a leader in this space. You've got to deal with all these questions and lawsuits. So we'll have to follow the implementation here to see how this turns out. We've only got a couple minutes left, and we have a few emails here. Jackson writes in to say, my university isn't moving on divestment. What can students do to make a difference? And a somewhat related question is Clark, who emails to ask, is there research showing that divestment significantly reduces investment returns? He writes, I hear some investors prefer to be at the table to affect change. Do many large institutional investors actually affect change? Kirsten, I think both of those questions are probably in your wheelhouse about what students can do and if this has an effect on investment returns and greenhouse gas emissions.
So I do think that students having dialogue with their endowment investment staff directly really makes a difference. So you want to be sure that your endowment is really considering climate risk. You can look at the policies that those endowments have, their investment policy, their proxy voting policy. What signals are they sending when they go to annual general meetings of these companies that they hold? You can look at whether or not they're really moving money into the clean energy economy, and you can ask them to make their own net zero targets and issue their own climate action plans. So all of those steps are important. And if an endowment is not willing to divest, divestment's kind of a blunt tool. There are lots more nuanced ways that students can engage with the investment staff and say, show us your plan. What are you really doing to address climate risk and look for the opportunities of the clean energy economy that's coming? I would say, your other question about engagement. We manage with other partners around the world and an investor-led initiative called Climate Action 100 Plus, where investors come together to engage the heaviest emitting companies in the world around reducing their emissions. And those efforts, now going on for 6 years, have made a dramatic difference. Those investors have gotten the companies to set science-based targets, mm-hmm. and then really begin to issue the plans so that investors mm-hmm. can see, like, are they moving the money? Are they really yeah. doing what it's going to take to reduce emissions in the long run? So we do think yeah. it matters, sometimes not fast enough.
All right. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, but I want to thank all of you for joining us. I wish we had more time to discuss it. That's Dave Jones, Director of the Climate Risk Initiative at UC Berkeley Center for Law, Energy, and the Environment, Kirsten Snow Spaulding of Ceres Investor Network, and Malin Clark, partner at Third Economy. Thank you all so much for joining us on State of the Bay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Well, coming up after this break, we're going to hear an interview with State of the Bay's Fred Pitt and Marta Carrillo, coach of the all-girls robotics team, the Janksters, who have been entering Bay Area robotics competitions with their 125-pound robot, Rosa. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.
The Ruth Asawa School of the Arts is featuring its new musical, The Addams Family. It's a comical feast that embraces every father's nightmare. Wednesday Addams, the ultimate princess of darkness, is all grown up and in love. Produced by and starring students of the School of the Arts, now through March 17th at the School of the Arts Dan Christen Memorial Theater. Details online at Ruth Asawa. SOTAPTSA.org.
Welcome to State of the Bay.
I'm Fred Pitts.
We're all aware that this is the rainy season, but around the Bay and beyond, for many high school students, it's also robotics season. In the Bay Area, there are 35 FIRST Robotics high school teams that are hard work building a 125-pound robot that will meet challenges and compete in March and April all over California. Here today with us, we have Marta Carrillo. Marta is a veteran mentor for the all-girl robotics team called the Janksters, great name, from Notre Dame High School. Marta, welcome to State of the Bay.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. So this is, what, your 12th year as the lead mentor for the Janksters, is that correct?
This is my 12th year with the team.
So how did you get involved in this in the first place?
Probably like many volunteers, this was what my older daughter was very, very interested in. She really wanted to get her hands on building a robot. So she became part of the team. Anybody who's associated with the team see how much work the students put in and how much support they need. So I started off by helping, just making sure that they had meals. And then I was asked to review some of their documents for promotion and sponsorship. So I was business committee mentor for 2 or 3 years. And the school asked if I would consider being the coach or lead mentor. I do not have a degree in engineering or STEM. So it was a whole new thing that took me out of my comfort zone, which is what mm-hmm. I encourage the students to do. So really was able to implement a lot of strengths that I have with my soft skills and organizational skills to help the students bring to life their team and their ideas for the robots for competition.
That's impressive. Listen, FIRST Robotics is very big. I mean, what, there are like 3,000 teams around the world. Do you know how it got started?
So it got started with Dean Kamen and Woody Flowers. Woody Flowers was a professor at MIT who had a class that had a little robot competition. And his partnership with Dean Kamen, they took that class concept and created a competition for high school students. And Dean Kamen is known as a great entrepreneur, inventor. And so he reached out to companies and basically said, hey, you want to start laying down the foundation for your future employees. And you can do that by supporting the students financially as well as with mentoring. And so that was the call to action for technology companies who work in the STEM industries to provide mentors as well as to provide products and financial support to these teams.
Wow, that's cool. So how do the girls learn the skills to code and build robots?
On our team, we focus a lot on sustainability because we only have the students for 4 years. So we always know that we're going to be graduating our most knowledgeable and experienced students every year. So we focus on having the students teach students. Within that, the student leaders in the fall give this new student an exposure to the different areas of the team. And on our team, we have 4 committees. So we kind of break it down. We go through a series of workshops where they learn about soldering and wiring and basic coding and putting together a chassis and a gearbox and a movable mechanism.
Wow.
They learn how to CAD and use the tools in our shop.
Wow. Tell me a little bit about the FIRST competition challenge this year. I mean, what do the challenges usually entail?
So the challenge usually entails some sort of game piece, and the game piece varies from year to year. We've done, over my years, I've seen Frisbees, 24-inch diameter yoga balls, 9-inch balls, 6-inch balls, gears, boxes, cubes and cones. This year we have basically a donut, and it's being called a note. It's a musical theme this year called Crescendo. So the note gets delivered to the speaker and the amplifier, and then the robot at the end has to hang from a chain, and that's labeled the stage. So there are 2 shooting places that the note gets tossed into. So depending on which place you score the note, it's going to change the value of the scoring. There's also some effort for the teams to cooperate in FIRST. So there's a term in FIRST lingo called cooperation. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that even in competition, you can cooperate. And so in this particular challenge, they have the teams collaborate ahead of time and agree to do something together for extra points.
I actually saw that video of the competition online where they were throwing the note, and I kept watching and going, that's a donut, that's a note. Your explanation cleared up a lot of things for me. Thank you very much. This is really impressive. I wish they had this when I was in high school.
I do too. I wish I had had it in high school.
It would have been great. If I come to visit your team, what would I see?
You would see girls across four different areas in this building. One is a computer lab where I have my business committee working on a lot of graphic design work as we get ready to have t-shirts that highlight the team, buttons that we're going to give away at the competition. Also, the other computers are being used for CADing. So the students are using Onshape to use the computer to aid them with their design. And so they are working out the dimensions, the heights, the calculations for gear ratio all ahead of time before they start building. In the lab itself, you will see students using saws and sanders and laser cutters and CNC routers at our school. 2 weeks ago, they were making prototypes. At this point of the game, we are pretty much deep in the season, so they are making their final pieces that they have cut that they are finding are not working to their liking. So they're making adjustments. You'll see students helping each other carry heavy things. You said our robot is 125 pounds. In an all-girls team, that robot weighs more than most of my students.
But that's true. I do want to ask you this. How many of your students go on to STEM fields like robotics?
I've calculated that about 85% of my students go on to some sort of STEM field when they go into college to pursue their degrees.
That's amazing. That's really impressive. I like that. I understand your team won some awards that you were a finalist in, like, the Woody Flowers Award last year. First of all, congratulations.
Thank you.
Second of all, what is the Woody Flowers Award? Just so I know.
So as I mentioned earlier, Woody Flowers was one of the people who was the founder of FIRST. His strength was really in helping the students recognize that communication was very important and the motivation of students was at the forefront of the work that we do. And so in the FIRST community, he was well known for his ability to relate to the students really well. And so this award was named for him. He actually passed away about 3 years ago, so it's even more meaningful now. And the idea is to recognize mentors with good communication skills that really help motivate the students and help teach them what they need to know and grow as individuals. So at every competition, the students submit for one of their mentors to be nominated, and then a selection process that I'm not aware of how that goes, but the selection process goes about, and one of the adults gets selected. And so I was selected last year at the competition at the Silicon Valley Regional.
Wow. One final question. What are your hopes and dreams for your team this year?
That's a really good question. This year, March 1st and 2nd and 3rd, we'll be competing at the Silicon Valley Regional. And my team is choosing to travel down to Costa Mesa at the end of March to compete at the Orange County Regional. And hopefully if we qualify at one of those, maybe we'll get to compete at the World Championship, which will be held in Houston in April this year. I am really hoping to see the students put together a robot that they are proud of, that they've designed themselves, that they've built themselves, and that will function as they have strategized for it to do so when we go to competition.
That is an amazing hope and dream. I'm afraid we have run out of time, Martha, but this has been a pleasure. I've learned so much about robotics. Martha Carrillo, thank you so much for your time today. Best of luck to you and all the Bay Area FIRST teams in your competitions this whole season.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That was Martha Carrillo, lead mentor for the Jenksters, FIRST Robotics team number 1967 out of Notre Dame High School in San Jose. Martha, thanks again for your time today.
Well, that's State of the Bay this week. We hope you'll join us next Monday at 6 for my co-host Grace Wan talks to a leading expert who will debunk some common myths about aging. And we'll hear about the world's largest collection of Star Wars memorabilia at the museum Rancho Obi-Wan right here in the Bay. For more information about tonight's show, visit our State of the Bay page on KALW.org. And please remember to subscribe to the State of the Bay podcast wherever you listen so you don't miss an episode. If you have any questions or comments, please email us anytime at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Tonight's show was produced by Ann Harper and Heather Hughes. It was engineered by David Kwan, and D Minor was our board operator. I'm Ethan Elkind. Good night, and thanks for listening.
On the next Fresh Air, comic and actor Jenny Slate talks about pregnancy, childbirth, and motherhood, the subjects of her new comedy special. She'll do the voices of some of her animated characters, including Marcel the Shell, the lead character in her Oscar-nominated film, and she'll describe growing up in a house her family believed was haunted. Join us.
Tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock for Fresh Air, here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and online at klw.org. What a time now is 7 o'clock. A rebroadcast of this morning's Your Call is next.